You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution. Love and
Revolution. This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we bring you a special program. Now that the 4th of July fireworks are over and the smoke of nationalism has cleared slightly, it's time to pick up the trash on the beaches and look at truth instead of flag waving. According to historian and researcher Walter Konser, not to mention the second president of the United States, John Adams, the Revolutionary War was not what won our independence from Great Britain. And the answer to what did may surprise you to the point of rethinking everything you've been told about the founding of the United States of America.
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe Agwanu. Greetings and welcome to you in my native language. I'm coming to you today from my home in the Dawnland in Bunawabskek Territory, in and along the shores of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine. It's a gray and cloudy day here today, and the atmosphere has been a bit oppressive with some of the recent events, but we're going to try to uplift you with some hopeful conversation today, and I'm joined, as always, by my radiant co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. You know, I was out in the Pacific Northwest for the 4th of July and just got a real up-close and personal view of our militarism, our nationalism, and our addiction to violence, which we've seen the repercussions of this week in all sorts of news channels, both abroad and overseas with our military and domestically. So today we're going to challenge some of the myths of how effective violence is, or that violence is necessary, or that violence is the only part of the American narrative, that this is how we define ourselves, because I think it's critically important at this time in our history that we learn another side of the story, that we both grapple with our unjust use of violence, which has been a long strand in American history, continuous strand, I would say, and that we learn the other kinds of effective measures of making change that actually are very deeply woven into our history as well. Today we have Walter Konser, who is a professor of religion and history at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. He's also the co-editor with Gene Sharp, who is a preeminent researcher of nonviolent action, and others who together have co-edited a book called Before Lexington, Resistance, Politics, and the American Struggle for Independence between 1765 and 1775. This book is coming out very shortly from the Albert Einstein Institution, and I've had the pleasure of talking with Walter quite a bit about this subject and listening to some of his research, and I know that you guys are going to want to take out a piece of paper and a pencil, or maybe your iPad, and take some notes on what he's going to bring up. This is a lot of good information for bringing up at your kitchen table.
Well, we're very excited to be able to have this conversation with you today. I've been really looking forward to this discussion and looking at some of the historical context for nonviolent action and, you know, hopefully bringing that forward into the place that we are at today and how we can incorporate that into the work that we're doing. You've done an incredible amount of research into the role of nonviolent action in the American Revolution. And I would love it if you could tell our audience a little bit about that work and what you've discovered.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to join you and your audience in this conversation today. Our research has focused on the decade of nonviolent struggle between roughly 1765 and 1775. And this was a decade of nonviolent struggle that focused on resistance to the Stamp Act, the Townsend Act, and the Coercive Acts. And the upshot of this resistance was that this decade of resistance undermined American allegiance to British institutions and replaced it with the development of parallel American institutions. And what that meant was that this decade of nonviolent struggle established de facto independence from the British in a majority of the 13 colonies prior to the outbreak of military hostilities. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about what all of this research shows, and then perhaps indicate some of what I think to be the significance of it. The popular narrative about this decade of struggle, historians will all recognize it, there were these campaigns of resistance, but typically they're thought of as being the prelude to the later military campaigns where the real action takes place. Interestingly, John Adams, who was the second president of the United States and actively involved in these campaigns of resistance, stated the following: "The American Revolution is not the history of military operations, but rather the American Revolution was in the union of the colonies, in the minds and hearts of the American people, before the commencement of military hostilities." So Adams recognized that the real revolution took place before the Battle of Lexington and Concord. And so that's what we're trying to talk about in this book, that the revolution is not to be thought of as the war of for independence, the war for independence. So in this kind of context, you've got a decade of resistance, and during this decade of resistance, there were all manner of methods of protest and persuasion, but typically these were always improvised. They were demonstrations, they were parades, they were political theater, political symbols, a number of things like this that took place in this decade. More significant, however, was this decade of non-cooperation, these strategic campaigns using non-importation, where they would boycott British goods, non-consumption, where the colonists would promote American-made goods and would buy American and would not buy, not consume British goods. And then finally, non-exportation, where they would refuse to send raw materials from America, to England. So campaigns of non-importation, non-consumption, non-exportation. These were the strategic campaigns taking place during this decade of resistance that had wide popular support in the 13 colonies. Now, the upshot of this non-cooperation, this decade of non-cooperation, was the development of parallel American institutions, things like the Stamp Act Congress or the Committees of Correspondence, or most especially, the First Continental Congress that met in 1774 in Philadelphia. At the First Continental Congress, they developed a coordinated plan of resistance that involved all three of these strategic tactics: non-importation, non-consumption, non-exportation. And they also developed committees that would enforce these, non-violently enforce these, by ostracism and a number of ways to put pressure on people who didn't cooperate, not injuring them, not physically injuring them, but indeed putting pressure on individuals. But these were forms of enforcement to see these campaigns through. Now, in this kind of circumstance, it's really quite remarkable how successful many of these campaigns were. The campaign against the Stamp Act, for example, where they refused to use British goods and they refused to use the stamps and a number of things like this, what this did was to put pressure on British merchants, who then put pressure on British politicians, and the Stamp Act was repealed due to nonviolent resistance. Now, of course, the British politicians couldn't admit that. They had to have some sort of face-saving mechanism, and they said, oh, we just decided to do it ourselves. But it's very clear that nonviolent action was quite successful in the repeal of the Stamp Act. Non-consumption also helped to grow the American economy. And so what we find is non-cooperation systemically in economic, social, political spheres replaced the allegiance of Americans to British institutions and replaced those old British institutions with new American institutions. So all of this is quite significant, I think, and is very important in reassessing the role of nonviolent action. Now, in that kind of context, I guess there are a couple of other questions that normally come up in this situation. One is to say, well, what about the war? I mean, there was a war, clearly. And instead of thinking that the move to military actions was inevitable, I would argue that it represents a shift in strategy. When the Second Continental Congress met in May of 1775, this would have been after Lexington and Concord. They authorized the Continental Army, and they authorized George Washington to be commander-in-chief. This represented nothing that was inevitable, but it represented a political choice. However, what it also represented was a political choice that was not very well thought out. There were very few strategic considerations of the implications of this shift to military struggle. Nonviolent action works by having a broad base of support, by manipulating third parties such as British merchants who could then put pressure on British politicians. Well, after military hostilities break out, third-party support in England completely evaporates, and military advisors take over in America, they take over in Britain, and you have a very, very different kind of struggle taking place.
Well, that seems to me that it really begs the question of, did we need a war? Could the revolution have continued to operate in nonviolent action terms and nonviolent conflict? I mean, we have seen since the American Revolution a number of violent revolutions, but also a growing and increasing number of nonviolent revolutions, including famously the Indian struggle for independence, the Philippines people-powered revolution, the fall of the Soviet bloc through predominantly nonviolent revolutions, including in Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Serbia, Ukraine, the first revolution. It really begs the question, and perhaps you have put some thought into this, could the revolution, in your estimation, successfully have escalated into a complete nonviolent defense of the nation? Because I think the Revolutionary War could really be thought of as the War of Reclamation, where they'd lost the colonies, basically, and Great Britain had lost the colonies, and they were trying to get them back. What's your take on, was the war necessary? Could it have been nonviolent? Is this even a possibility?
Yeah, that's a very, very excellent question, because if this is a shift in strategy and nothing inevitable, then it does raise this tactical question. Well, could nonviolent action have succeeded? And I think unequivocally it could have, for a variety of reasons. One, nonviolent action works by a broad basis of support, and that was already in evidence. There was, in fact, in every colony, a broad basis of support for these resistance campaigns. Secondly, if the British had, what would the British do? Well, they would try to occupy the 13 colonies, all right? And what would they tell people to do? Well, buy our goods. Well, I'm not going to buy your goods. No, thanks. You know, I mean, all these forms of non-cooperation would persist and continue. And you wouldn't have that dramatic incident like the Battle of Yorktown, perhaps, in which case you could say we won or we lost. But I don't think there's any question but that with the extended lines of supply that would be necessary to keep the British occupation forces supplied, that those would have broken down very quickly, that there was broad popular support in America, and that the outcome would have looked differently than the outcome of the military situation. But what happened was that basically Americans had achieved their independence, and they ended up defending it with military action. I think they could have certainly continued that, and they would have faced challenges. There was no question about that. There would have been repression. But historians have also pointed out that only 40% of the white population actively supported the Patriot cause once it became military. That 20% desertion rate was normal in the American Army. So this armed resistance polarized American society when it moved to that. And clearly also there would have been sacrifices that would have taken place. But it's hard to believe that the 4,400 deaths that occurred from the military hostilities, that anything close to that would have taken place if there had been nonviolent struggle. So I think the answer is yes, that this could have been a struggle, but it could have happened. Now, you probably are familiar with Erica Chenoweth and book that talks about civil resistance between 1900 and 2006, and they point out that violent campaigns succeeded about half, well, 26% of the time, and nonviolent campaigns succeeded 53% of the time. So it's not at all hard to imagine that what was taking place in the 20th century could also have taken place in the 18th.
There's an interesting correlation here between what's going on in the world today and what was going on in the world during the 18th century. I think that primarily we're looking at a continuation of wars and separation that are based on religion. And I know that you've done an incredible amount of work looking at the role of religion in historical context. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the role of religion in framing both violent and nonviolent action. We spoke with Ken Buttigan a short time ago on the show about the meeting at the Vatican to determine whether or not they were going to eliminate the just war theory and replace it with the just peace theory. And I think that when we look at some of these actions, we have to look at the fundamental underlying beliefs that motivate people. And I think that religion is probably a primary motivating factor for a lot of people. Certainly economics is a motivating factor for people as well. Would you be willing to talk with us a little bit about the role of religion in framing both violent and nonviolent action?
Yeah, of course. One thing I think that would be very interesting in this context is, of course, we're well aware of a very important and deep tradition of Christian pacifism. And people often think of Christian pacifism as being the only expression for nonviolent, or the only foundation for nonviolent action. As a matter of fact, during the colonial era, the use of nonviolent action was primarily done by people who thought in pragmatic terms, not in principle terms. These were not principled pacifists in the colonies who were engaging in nonviolent action. These were individuals who said, we must struggle, we must resist, we don't have anywhere near enough guns or anything like that to successfully resist the British. We are going to use nonviolent action because we must resist and because we think this will work. And then their experience demonstrated to them that it did work, in fact. But they did not have a thorough understanding of nonviolent action, and many of their decisions were improvised at the time. Now, to your broader question about the role of religion, well, certainly among what you might think of as clergy, congregational clergy, for example, that were in New England, or other Protestant clergy, because it was typically the Protestants were the large majority in all of the colonies. These Protestant preachers supported the resistance campaigns. There's all sorts of amusing examples of where ministers would gather the women in their congregation together, and they would get their spinning wheels out, and they would start producing American-made cloth, you know, just like Gandhi did quite a bit later. Or the sermon literature, where the preachers would say that, you know, we need to resist oppression, we need to work for justice, we have a God is on our side. So, but that was all supporting nonviolent resistance. So the notion of resisting evil, well, that has deep, deep roots in religion, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to resist evil with violence. So that equation between religion and violence, while we see it in regrettably in so many circumstances, is not a necessary one.
Well, my question is a little bit akin to religion, but more in the realm of mythos and ideology. One of the things that we get from the American Revolution as Americans is the founding myth of violence. And whenever I get up and start talking about the nonviolent action side of the American Revolution, I inevitably get pushback from people who are a little bit attached to their guns, I would say. They're stuck to their guns. And they often have a forefather who fought in the American Revolution, or they are very attached to, say, the Second Amendment, which is, one could arguably say, it's based on the experience of the American Revolution and the importance of the perceived importance of the militia. And so I really would love to ask you a little bit about what you think the repercussions of the choice of violence and the overshadowing of the nonviolent action, which we didn't have a lot of words to talk about or describe at that point in time. The word boycott would not be invented for another 100 years, for example. In weaving into our mythos as an American populace, particularly the white American populace that really won out through the use of violence, basically, the role and importance of guns and violence in defense, in establishing the dominance of the American colonies and winning their independence. And what is the parallel shadow side of history that we're not getting, and how does that affect us? That I studied the American Revolution for 6 years through flukes of school redistricting and changes of curriculum, and did not know the nonviolent side of the American Revolution. So what is the effect of these narratives on our world, our arc as a nation, and the contemporarily as well?
Yeah, I think those are all very, very important questions. Now, part of what this research helps us do is be better informed about the large number of very successful examples of nonviolent action in our own history. More specifically, by focusing on the revolution, we're trying to reframe the story of national origins. And of course, that, you know, the story of national origins for any country provides conceptions of national identity for the people who share them. So what, you know, we think of July 4th just a couple of days ago, that's a celebration of for many people, the charter events, enshrining particular historical episodes, privileging specific historical interpretations. Well, what this counter-narrative does is say that's not the only story. And in fact, it may not be the most accurate story as well. Militia, for example, when the Second Continental Congress authorized the militias to be the foundation for the Continental Congress, not all of the colonies had militias. In fact, just a handful of them had militias in place. And those militias were largely intended, they were very small scale and largely intended to deal with escaped slaves or defense against Indians or something like this. It was, in short, nothing at all like a national army or what was going to become the Continental Congress. So part of what we're doing here is, I think, is changing the narrative. Now, the Second Amendment's a whole different discussion, and how people think that their own handgun relates them to militia defense is another issue. But I think one thing that's very interesting is this point about the wide level of support. When you have the shift to military strategy, then who are the actors? Young adult males. And that's pretty much it, because they're the ones who are fit enough to fight. In the nonviolent struggle, you had males of all ages, females of all ages, and even children involved in these struggles. So one could imagine if one were a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution or had a relative who fought in the revolution, well, that's all well and good, but there'd be so much broader potential for participation among many more women, for example, who could become thought of as Daughters of the American Revolution by looking at the nonviolent resistance rather than the military struggle. So if you were trying to get members, new members, recruiting new members for the Daughters of the American Revolution, I think one would do better to emphasize the broad range of female participation in the nonviolent action struggles than the relatively small number of females who had anything to do with the Continental Army. Does that speak to your question?
Yes, that does, and I have some further questions about some of that, but I'll get back to that later because I'd love to hear Sherry chime in, and I'm not sure if you're going to add a note of Indigenous perspective at this point in the show, but I'd love to open the space for that.
Well, of course. I think that the interesting piece here is when we're talking about these historical movements and we're talking about the, in some sense, the validity of different types of action, and looking at framing certain events within history as being noble or heroic, it can't be overlooked. We can't allow it to go by without speaking truth to the fact that all of the things that were being done here were at the expense of the original peoples of this land, and that nonviolence in one area does not always translate into nonviolence in another area, that we have this spectrum of acceptability of violence, which we're seeing right now play out all over the media, where people are either outraged or completely complacent to the deaths of young black men by the police. So I just wanted to mention that, you know, we can't discuss these things without putting that within our frame of reference also, to really be willing to look at these specific layers of privilege that are kind of woven throughout the entire history, and that we're still in a struggle for not just equality, but equanimity in this country in so many ways. And a lot of those things go back to racial divides that were present at the very beginning of this country's founding and that are still playing out centuries later on the public stage in really violent ways. Another thing I want to talk to you about is you talked about states' militia and that not all of the colonies had their own militia at that point in time, and that they had a limited scope and purpose in a lot of ways.
Correct,
and so
yes.
When we're thinking about how this translates into a modern context today, the police state is much more sophisticated. It's much larger. It has a much greater degree of control over the population. And the weapons that are being used now are far more deadly than the ones that were used in the past. And so how do we reconcile those differences and still integrate these practices for nonviolent action when we see that nonviolent action is leading to a considerable amount of violence? People are getting beaten by the police. People are, their constitutional rights are constantly being violated. We have people that are being shot at peaceful protests. And so how do we incorporate the present day reality with the change in weaponry and the change in the nature of the police state from then to now, and be able to integrate and incorporate that into what we're doing as we move forward?
Well, those are very profound questions. I do not obviously have anything like simple answers or straightforward answers. Conflict situations are part of the human experience, and how we resolve those conflicts is very, very significant. Nonviolent action has its own dynamics. It has statistically demonstrated results. Gene Sharp has pretty clearly argued the ways in which violence tends to drive away potential supporters, and violence tends to concentrate power, whereas nonviolence tends to diffuse it. So there will continue to be struggles, there will continue to be sacrifices, there will continue to be deaths. People, you know, the repression, the forces of repression are quite real. They were in the 18th century, they are in the 21st century. And so in this kind of context, the question seems to me is not should we resist, but how do we resist? How is that best organized? And what are the forms of action, either violence or nonviolence, that promise the best results? And those have to be looked at very carefully in terms of each individual situation. But I think in terms of broad dynamics, nonviolent action is not simply passive. It is not simply the weapon of the weak, and it is not inevitable that military conflict will always be the superior choice, or will always inevitably be where the conflict has to conclude. Now, again, those are not directly related to answering your question, but it seems to me that they provide us with the context for thinking about how struggle needs to continue, and what advantages nonviolent struggle has in that continuum of conflict. And these are all issues to which Gene Sharp has written very eloquently.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence. On this week's Nonviolence Minute, we're going to take a moment to dig a little deeper into the impacts of the founding myth of violence. Now, it's important to note that no one's saying that the Revolutionary War didn't happen. It obviously did. We obviously won the war, and we obviously kicked Great Britain out. What is in contention, however, is that the very notion that violent armed struggle is what got us the deeper socio-political goals that the early colonists professed to want. Freedom, liberty, self-governance, an end to unfair taxation without representation, and a variety of other stated goals. As Walter Konser has been telling us on the show today, those goals were largely achieved prior to the outbreak of war and won through organized widespread nonviolent action. Erica Chenoweth and Maria Steffen's study compared over 300 cases of both violent and nonviolent struggles and found that nonviolent struggles tended to give rise to more democratic freedoms and civil liberties, while violent conflicts tended to have the opposite effect. This is a startling finding, one that challenges American identity, especially after decades of wars that have been justified to the public as struggles to bring democracy and liberation to the countries that we wage war in. It forces us to ask the question, what really brings freedom and democracy? And if nonviolence is demonstrating itself to be a more effective tool for achieving those goals, should we continue to support the use of armed struggle in that context? Another sobering question is, if violence is not bringing freedom and democracy, what exactly is it achieving? Well, to use just one example in recent history, following the inception of the War on Terror, we Americans have seen a constriction of our civil liberties, violations of our First and Fourth Amendment rights, the abuse of power by a militarized police force, mass surveillance, defunding of social programs and education to support an ever-inflating war budget, and a pantheon of disturbing side effects of being in a state of permanent and largely undeclared borderless war. Annually, the founding myth of the United States informs our children and citizens that guns and rockets' red glare and bombs bursting in air brought us the freedom and democracy we profess to believe in. The knowledge and history that Walter Konser is offering for our consideration during this show challenges that notion heads-on. Certainly, our own history backs up the examples set by the struggle for independence. The major social, economic, political, and cultural achievements of the United States in the direction of freedom, respect, equality, fairness, and justice have been largely formed by nonviolent movements for change, including several waves of labor movements, the women's rights movement, suffrage movement, civil rights movement, environmental movement, the movement for the American Disability Act, and the health and safety campaigns to end pollution and toxicity in our air, water, land, food, housing, and products, and many more other movements for social justice. It's time for a deep re-evaluation of the types of action that have achieved the reality of our professed ideals. If nonviolent action is what won independence and achieved those social advances we just mentioned, why do we continue to repeat the myth of righteous violence? Why not teach our children how nonviolent action works, what it has accomplished in our own history and around the world, and how societies worldwide use it to achieve freedom and democracy? Our stories define our actions in the world, so let's tell a true story about violence and about nonviolence, and then make our choices accordingly. Today's interview with Walter Konser is a great example of why we always say on Love and Revolution Radio, know your nonviolent history. It might change your life.
One more time I'll sing a song. Other time I'll break my thumb.
This week's featured music is How to Do by Chris Ballandes and Emma Production on his Campfire Acoustics album. You can find it on Jamendo.com under Campfire Acoustics. And now, let's return to our interview with Walter Konser. I want to ask a few questions about the choice to change strategies from nonviolent actions into armed struggle during the Revolutionary War. And one of the dynamics that Maria Steffen and Erica Chenoweth discovered in their book, Why Civil Resistance Works, in their research, is that violent conflict tends to lead into further civil wars, it leads into centralization of power, command structures, restrictions on democratic freedoms, and what we would call civil liberties today. So I want to ask a little bit about the choice to switch from nonviolent action, which was broad-based, as you said, it was also fairly dispersed. It had many leaders, I would say, and many people organizing small actions throughout the colonies. And then we switched to an armed struggle in which George Washington particularly emerges as a central figure of this. He goes on to become the wealthiest man in America, largely by the land grabs that accompanied the Revolutionary War. Not to really dig too hard at George Washington. He is one of our favorite people to mythologize, but he then went on to become the president of the United States, and he oversaw a shift in the governing structure of the colonies from the Articles of Confederation, which were by no means perfect at all, to the current Constitution, and was part of the faction that inserted the clauses in the articles to the Constitution that gave rise to what became corporate power. My question is really, what do you perceive in the shift and change of tactics that led towards the centralization of power and the disenfranchisement of many of the people who formerly thought they were going to be enfranchised through the American Revolution? What can we see in the shifts of dynamic and power around the choice of tactics in this era?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Those are excellent questions. I think clearly, as I've said before, nonviolent action works and as you indicated, a diffuse, decentralized, broadly based campaign, whereas the shift to military constricted the numbers of participants. It made it a command structure with military advisors who had no background in nonviolent action in those campaigns becoming the leaders. So what we have is a constriction of the actual campaigns themselves. And beyond that, then, what are the implications of that? Well, when you move then from the Second Continental Congress into the Continental Army and then into the emergence of the new United States, you maintain this dominant, constricted leadership situation. And it is, not surprisingly, instead of reflecting exclusively a military background, it now is expanded to include powerful, rich, and typically, in all cases, I guess one would have to say, white and male leadership. So that it is clear that the constriction of leadership and the constriction of the campaigns that we see taking place in this shift of strategy continues into the constitutional era, when the Constitution, Articles of Confederation, and then Constitution were formed. It is, just in terms of what Sherry was talking about, it is, of course, of interest that Benjamin Franklin had, in the Albany Plan of Union in 1754, had recognized the Iroquois example and was influenced in part by the Iroquois example as a way of bringing the disparate 13 colonies into some kind of union. Now, the Albany Plan of Union was not adopted, but where the Iroquois nation had found a way to resolve intertribal disputes, so too was Franklin trying to suggest, with the Iroquois example at least in mind, that there are ways for the colonies to politically amalgamate into a federal union, and one that would be equitable. And so it's interesting just to look at the influence of the Native Americans, the Iroquois people particularly, on the deliberations about the Constitution and American political situations in general.
There are so many arguments out there regarding whether or not any of those principles were incorporated into the Constitution and the formation of the U.S. government. If you ask some historians, they say, no, they weren't adopted. If you ask other historians, they say, yes, they were adopted. So I think it's interesting that you bring that subject up. I also think that it's really interesting that we tend to discredit a lot of the historical events. We discredit a lot of the historical relationships that existed when we talk about the forming of this country. And what puzzles me, I think, most about our unwillingness to look accurately at our history and to kind of cherry pick what we choose to acknowledge within our history is that the playing out of that history actually shapes our future. And so we can't accurately chart a course into the future that is going to be accurate if we don't have the starting point of that map delineated. And I think that we tend to romanticize and to kind of overshadow some of the issues that may make us or those that we're associated with look unfavorably. And as we're trying to figure out, I guess my concern or my interest in all of this is, how do we translate all of what's happened in the past into the charting of a new direction into the future? Because we've been operating for more than 17 centuries on different aspects of violence. We've been operating under a industrial, you know, the military industrial complex for so long that it seems to be the norm. There's cognitive dissonance for people to think about charting a path forward that doesn't include violence as a form of ensuring our safety. But as we've discussed, as Rivera's mentioned, you've mentioned certainly the work of Erica Maria that you mentioned highlights very clearly that none of these things make us safer, that we've actually fundamentally been making ourselves more and more unsafe, making the world more and more unsafe as we've been acting out this dynamic of increased and expanded warfare upon the world. And so when we think about the scale of the problems that need to be addressed, it can be incredibly overwhelming. And so when we think about these strategies and we think about the things that you were talking about earlier about importation, exportation, non-cooperation, those are things that we can do at a very small local level. So I want to talk a little bit about, I want you to talk a little bit about how we translate those specific actions to address, how do they address the larger problems that we're all facing on a global scale that can be so incredibly overwhelming for people, because they look at this long history of more than 17 centuries, and certainly acts of war have been glorified far more than acts of nonviolence. We're aware of them if we choose to become aware of them. Like Rivera said, she didn't learn about any of those things during her educational processes. And so how do we overcome this embedded mindset, this ideology that's associated with 17 to 20 centuries of violence, and actually start shifting so that we can make nonviolence more attractive and more the norm for people? Because it doesn't give you a quick result, and we're a just add water society. It's a long, drawn out process that we need to be patient for. So how do we bring that into the foreground and help to highlight the simple things that we can do in our small local areas to address some of these bigger problems? Is there a strategy that you can recommend that we put forward to be able to do that?
Well, I think one point that you're making that with which I completely agree is that it's important to become better informed. Too often we, because of the predominance of a military and a violent rhetoric, we accept the idea that nonviolent action doesn't work. And that's just flat out wrong. The number of times in which nonviolent action has been successful in the 20th century, as the other authors have pointed out, is remarkable. The number of historical examples that are now being fully researched and made available, such as this discussion on the American Revolution, validate in more ways than one the fact that nonviolent action is a realistic alternative, and that it will not always succeed, but for that matter, neither does military action always succeed. And in this kind of circumstance, then, we need to think creatively about what conflict situation one finds oneself in, and there's not one answer to fit all situations, but part of what this research does is to inform us that nonviolent action has worked in the past, and that, as you talked about that map, we need to, you know, figure out our origins. Well, that our origins can be very persuasively argued to reside in a nonviolent struggle rather than in a military struggle. I think that also then gives us the potential to be inspired, for future campaigns, to be inspired by the fact that nonviolent action has worked in the past, and that military action or military hostilities and the rhetoric of violence is not the only alternative. if people believe that the only alternatives are either submission or violence, then they're gonna take up the gun. But if you can provide clear, compelling evidence that nonviolent action can in fact work, that it has its own dynamics by which it is by which it's successful, then I think that you provide an alternative. Then the next question, as you're posing, is how do you organize people? And that typically is around local issues. And that depends, of course, on the situation. But part of what works with nonviolent action is its broad base of support. And what that does psychologically is destroy that sense of individualism that is paralyzed, that paralysis of individualism, that there's nothing I can do, there's nothing, these problems are insurmountable, there's nothing that I can do as an individual, and so I'll just not do anything, in apathy. Well, instead, if one can see oneself as part of a larger collective struggle, I think that provides psychological reinforcement. And that's the way that nonviolent action works. It works through a broad basis rather than through a command structure from above.
Walter, I want to ask you another kind of complex and possibly challenging question since I'm on a roll already in this show. You mentioned that the nonviolent actions associated with the American independence movement had a positive effect on the economics of the American colonies. And as we're looking a little bit more deeply at that and what that means, I'd also like to just keep in mind that today our struggle is not against a nation such as Great Britain. Our struggle on the economic level of dominance and monopoly and tyranny is really on the global transnational corporate level. So would you speak a little bit more about the building of alternative economic institutions, the non-importation and non-cooperation and non-consumption strategies that the colonists use to resist Great Britain's dominance and tyranny, and how that might be applicable to our situation that we're facing today within the corporate dominance that we're dealing with?
I think the fundamental parallel is there's twofold. It's people power and the refusal to cooperate. In both of those, in both the current context and in the 18th century context, the parallel there is people organizing together and refusing to, for example, purchase British goods. That was the 18th century experience. To exercise boycotts, to exercise consumer development so that you get economic self-sufficiency, to develop small scale because it's personal, it's familiar, it's immediate, small scale cooperatives. Now, that's not going to bring down the Leviathan of capitalism overnight or anything like that, but it would be a way in which individuals on a small scale can work to achieve positive results. What happened in the 18th century was that these campaigns of non-importation, non-consumption, non-exportation were remarkably successful. The boycotts of British goods completely devastated the British import, the British exports to America, or the British imports by Americans. It's remarkable when you look at the statistics how effective those campaigns were. That put pressure on the British economy, and then the British merchants put pressure on the British politicians. Again, the common theme there is non-cooperation. It's the refusal to cooperate. It's the refusal to, in this case, purchase British goods. And concomitant with that was the development of American economic alternatives. Now, you know, we're only talking about 10 years, so it's not as if the American economy was transformed over those 10 years, because it still was basically a mercantile capitalist economy. But the in individual colonies, the results of these attempts at developing American-made goods were really quite remarkable in a number of cases. One of the interesting things was that America was a source of raw materials for England. Consequently, non-exportation would have been a very powerful tool. And unfortunately, it was only in the First Continental Congress in 1774 that measures to implement non-exportation were even discussed, and the war broke out before those measures could be tested. So it's entirely possible that non-exportation would have been even more powerful in bringing about pressure on the British government than non-importation or non-consumption. Those common themes and organizing together and through basically people power, as we hear in so many other cases, and working to develop independent, autonomous organizations that can operate to not cooperate with the, in this case, the British, those were critical in these resistance campaigns.
I wonder if those tools that we're talking about when you're talking about addressing importation and exportation, certainly they're effective in regard to putting pressure on specific industries. We've seen that with the actions that have taken place around the world. And my concern, I guess, is that we're not looking at, I mean, we're talking about an oligarchy, but we're not really looking at, in reality, one central structure. What we're looking at is Hydra with 1,000 heads and a number of different interests at play and individual members of Congress being beholden to any number of those different interests. And so when we start putting pressure on our government to address specific issues, we're having to navigate a number of new areas that we really weren't having to navigate in the past in quite the same ways. The sophistication level is very different, I think, as we've grown and changed. The sophistication of those in positions of power and how to maintain that power have also changed. They've diversified in a number of ways, making it almost like a whack-a-mole game to try to really get to one centralized issue, even though we say we have this centralized form of governance. There really is no direct center that you can look at because there are so many different players in the field and so many different interests at play at any given time that it becomes a challenge to know where is the most effective area to put your energy. And so people are tirelessly addressing one issue after another, and it's never ending and it's exhausting. And it's demoralizing to some people in a lot of ways. And they feel like they're never going to be able to get anywhere. So how do we address that diversification of interests and all of these different areas where power is hidden within this seemingly centralized system?
Well, obviously, that's a very, very complex question, and one, again, which for which I have no simple answers. The Albert Einstein Institution, I think, continues to do research in areas related to how to make nonviolent action more effective, particularly in the face of repression by governments that are themselves becoming more effective in, as you say, in repressing resistance. This is a continuing issue, how to confront repression when it comes down, as it inevitably will, from those in government. Now, as to other kinds of questions, you know, again, one has to, as it were, keep the faith and be buoyed by the knowledge that nonviolent action can work, has worked, and there's a very good chance that it will continue to work. Facing increasingly complex situations of social injustice demands thoughtful, strategic thinking, not emotional responses. And so one of the reasons why historical research is useful is that it demonstrates alternatives in our history. It demonstrates the ways in which power has been confronted, and it demonstrates how social justice has been sought by any number of unsung heroes in our history. Obviously, nonviolent action played a significant role in the civil rights movement. It played a very important role in the women's movement. It plays and continues to play an important role in the labor movement. All of these examples within American history. Internationally, we can see success stories in the use of nonviolent action as well. And so these ought to give us hope. They ought to give us courage. And they have strategic lessons to be learned or to be taught from these. Be learned from these episodes, those can be useful as we confront problems in the 21st century.
Well, thank you for that, Walter. I want to just take a moment and remind our listeners that Walt Konser is a professor of religion and history at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. He's also the co-editor, along with Gene Sharp and others, of a book that's coming out very shortly called Before Lexington, Resistance Politics and the American Struggle for Independence in 1765 to 1775. So, Walter, one question, just at the end of the show, as we're getting ready to say goodbye to our listeners today, is where can they find this book? And the other question is, what should they think about in both acknowledging that violence is a part of our history and that violence isn't necessarily what got us what we wanted, and at the same time inserting the narrative of how nonviolent action played a role? How could people in tangible ways go about doing that in their world?
Okay. The book will be published by the Albert Einstein Institution in Boston. You can go to their website and there will be information, contact information, and you can inquire from them. Now, as to the other question, it's interesting. In Gene Sharp's work, The Politics of Nonviolent Action and Waging Nonviolent Struggle, he lists 198 different methods by which nonviolent action works. One can look at that 198 different methods and gain inspiration, gain ideas, gain some sense of possible things that an individual can do, that a group could do, that groups together could do, using nonviolent action in an effective and courageous fashion. So in all of those ways, I think that Sharp's work is just foundational for movements for social change that want to use nonviolent action. And he is an inspiration to all of us who have a commitment to nonviolence.
Well, and likewise, you are an inspiration to those of us who need to know a little bit more about the nonviolent side of our history. Thank you for joining us on Love and Revolution Radio.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution. Love, love, love and revolution.
Thanks this week to our guest, Walter Konser, and thanks to my wonderful co-host, Sherry Mitchell, with all of her insightful comments and words of wisdom on this show. Our theme song is Love and Revolution with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson in Spirit Radio. You can find her music at www.dianepatterson.org.
I'd also like to thank my wonderful co-host, Rivera Sun, for her presence. If you enjoyed this show, you might also enjoy the things that I post on my Facebook page, Sacred Instructions, which can be found on the Love and Revolution webpage and on the podcast. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on Rivera Sun's website. And we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. July 4th has come and gone, listeners, and it's time to let the smoke of the fireworks clear and pick up the litter on the beach. On this week's show, Walter Konser has challenged us to look deeper than just the fireworks of the Revolutionary War and understand how nonviolent civil resistance gave strength to the movement for independence. Maybe you'll take a moment to challenge the culture and mythos of violence and armed struggle by digging deeper into this history by the time we talk to you next week.